Commentaries are for entertainment only. The views and opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You are listening to KFAR Radio. We're at 660 on the AM dial, 97.5 on the FM dial, and we live stream at kfarradio.com. This is Problem Corner. I'm your host, David Prus. If you want to call in today with the guest or with a question or a thought, we're at 907-458-8255. Today's a Wednesday, but more importantly, it's the second Wednesday of the month. Therefore, I have the exceptional seat in the studio with Nick Nugent. How you doing, sir?
I'm very well, Dave. Thank you.
You know, I like Wednesdays on this show. You know, you come in with just exceptional stuff. Joni will come in, and I'll throw a few other things in on a Wednesday. Wednesday's probably the most favorite show day that we have from people who talk to me. So thank you. Thank you, Nick, for being, you know, a backbone on that, major contributor.
Well, thank you.
I really appreciate it.
I'm glad we can take the pain out of hump day.
Well, right, you know, at noon, we're on the backside of the week.
That's true.
So, what are we, you know, we're doing a good one today. Why don't you explain to Fairbanks what we're doing?
Well, today we're going to talk about the schooner Nanook and the loss of Carl Ben Ileson. The Nanook was a fur-trading ship. It was a schooner-rigged sailing ship with an internal combustion engine.
Okay.
And a Navy guy can tell you all about the different riggings. I just look at them, and they're ships with sails and ships without. So,
true.
You know, in the fall of 1929, they were trapped in the ice near North Cape Siberia. The story takes place basically from June of 29 to March of 1930. It involves quite a cast of U.S. and Russian sailors and airmen. It takes place in what was the far eastern Arctic coast of Siberia, which is pretty much, as you look at the maps, directly west of Point Lay. So Russia dips down a little bit farther than Alaska does.
Yeah, I worked in Point Lay one summer. Okay. Construction, yeah, goodness.
And it also ends up involving a who's who of Northern Aviation in that day. Among those involved were Joe Crossan, Frank Dorband, Ben Ileson, Harold Gillam, Jim Hutch Hutchison, and Captain T.M. Reed from Canada, Ed Young, and Noel Ween.
There's always in aviation, there's always a Ween involved.
It seems like there is.
Always. You know, there better be if there's not.
They were the first to start so many things, and I think were willing to attempt flights that may have just caused other people to not be so enthusiastic.
And it's so neat because you still have family, the Ween family, here in Fairbanks. You have Kelly, and you have Leslie, and they're still here in Fairbanks. And just exceptional people.
Well, the area involved was probably as little known by the Russians as it was by the rest of the world. The Tsar had had Vitus Bering explore the coast. He started out from Okhotsk in 1725, explored through 1728. From 1775 to 1779, Captain James Cook explored the Pacific, ducked up through the Bering Straits, and then came back out fairly quickly. Cook traveled as far north as Icy Cape and then west to where he did see Wrangel Island. So he got fairly far west by that day. Ferdinand von Wrangel explored the land between the Columbia River and North Cape during 1820 to 23. And finally, starting in the 1850s, Yankee whalers and others began to come into the area. and probably the Whalers knew as much about what was going on there as anyone did. And if you remember last month's subject, the Western Union Telegraph Company was in this area, 1864 through 1867.
We talked about that last show.
We did. Yeah, and some of the miserable time they had.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, we didn't even get into the mosquitoes they had to go through.
You know, I almost hate to bring up mosquitoes this time of year when people are free of them.
I apologize. My fault. My bad. We move on.
No, I don't want anyone to start getting anxiety this early in the year.
True.
Well, the Nanook then was a lumber schooner. It had been built in 1892 in Eureka, California by Hans Bendixson. He was an excellent, excellent boat builder. It was christened the Ottilie Fjord in 1923. It was sold to a company, the Northern Whaling and Trading Company, and renamed the Nanook. At this point, the ship was purchased by Olaf Svensson. And that was 1926, and he wanted to use it for his new Svensson Fur Trading Company. They added 2 inches of Australian ironbark for ice protection. Well, Svensson had been born in Michigan, but had come north with his father. He was born in 1883, and he came north for the Nome Gold Rush. So he came north as a pretty young guy. Mm-hmm. He was a late teenager at the time he came north. In 1902, they were really feeling like there wasn't much expansion left in Nome, and tired of that. So they went to Siberia and started looking for prospects there, got involved in the fur trade. Svensson opened his first fur post in 1904 when he would have been 21. He developed a thriving business which lasted until the Russian Revolution, when all of his holdings were confiscated. But his knowledge allowed him to negotiate for trading and transporting rights, bringing the furs to American markets. The Russian government liked the gold they got by selling the furs in the U.S. The new company had a 5-year contract, and he would purchase and transport a lot of Soviet-specified merchandise to the villages along the far eastern coast of Siberia. And the Russians then would pay for them and provide the furs of the region for the fur market. He could make a round trip from Seattle to the Kolyma River, which is a bit west yet of Wrangel Island. So it's a pretty good ways around, area where it's very easy to get trapped in ice. In 1926 and 7, the Nanook made trips through open ice and good weather, and the voyages only lasted around 3 months. And in 1928, conditions were quite different, probably more usual than unusual. They had purchased a second ship. The Illisif was purchased in Norway. Radios were added to both ships. The conditions were very bad on the water that year, especially north of the Bering Straits. The prop was damaged on Nanook, and it had to return to Seattle by sail, which was only 6.5 knots under sail, hull speed. They dropped cargo at Teller, which could be picked up by other ships and taken south for them. And by the end of August of 28, due to the weather, the Illisif had only reached North Cape, which is just kind of, if you will, around the corner from the Bering Straits. So they weren't very far along. They were frozen in there. Svensson had been on the ship. He made a 4,500-mile trip by dog, sled, and reindeer in midwinter to Irkutsk. From Irkutsk, he rode the Trans-Siberian Railroad to Moscow and eventually reached Seattle by way of New York. I think there's a story you could write a book on that alone.
He went 90% of the way around the world to get back to Seattle.
It's kind of like around the world in 80 days.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, their exposed position left the Illisif lashed by storms. The radio, though, was invaluable. They kept it going. They were able to communicate with the U.S. Army Signal Corps station at Nome, and messages were actually relayed as far as the homes of some of the Norwegian crew, which not many years before, if you were stuck in the ice, you were out of communication. Your family had no idea till you showed up at the door. Well, the ship radio was the only method of communication along that entire stretch of coast, so the Russians even would send parties out and bring them messages to be transmitted. Communication with Moscow allowed permission for flights from Alaska, and this was in the face of very poor quality of aviation gas available and unmapped expanses of over 450 miles, but Noel Ween set out from Nome, made the first flight to the ship on March 7th, 1929. The poor landing strip kind of necessitated that they had reduced loads. For unknown reasons, the Russian government canceled permission and no more were undertaken until October 1929.
So they had to basically gear up from Fairbanks, get to Nome getting out to there. In 1929.
Yes, and they would usually hop over to Teller to top the tanks of the aircraft off.
They just don't make them like that anymore.
No.
On Wednesdays, I always say that. They just don't make them like that anymore.
Certainly not. When we look at what happens to the crew of the Elisif later, they went through a pretty amazing ordeal themselves.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a quick commercial break. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
With stores in Anchorage, Wasilla, North Pole, Fairbanks, and throughout North America, Glass Doctor is your locally owned and operated solution when you need a windshield. With our G12 road hazard guarantee, you get 1 year peace of mind, knowing we will fix or replace your windshield if it gets damaged or broken for free in Alaska, where they put rocks on the road, like on purpose. It's practically a buy one, get one free kind of a deal. And only at Glass Doctor.
Call the Glass Doctor, we'll fix your pains. Oh, yeah.
How do you get the smoking best deal in town on just about anything? On 50-50 Fridays. Duh, that's how. 50-50 Fridays partners together with your favorite local merchants to bring you great new deals of half-off savings. Simply go to this station's website and click on the 50-50 Fridays button at the top of the page to see what new deal is being offered each week. Get ready to score your half-off deals on such items as dining out, entertainment, services, activities, events, and even more. Shop 50-50 Fridays. You'll spend less. You'll have more. And even if it isn't Friday, be sure to check back with the 50-50 Fridays page regularly, where you can discover unclaimed half-off deals that may still be available. Every 50-50 Fridays week, you'll hear about the upcoming offer daily on 8 of the most listened to radio stations in the interior. Can your business benefit from a week of saturated, enthusiastic promotion on 8 radio stations? The answer is yeah, it sure. Why wouldn't it? Talk to us. 50-50 Fridays, brought to you by the radio station, your local family of radio stations.
Weather brought to you by the Eye Clinic of Fairbanks. Your eyes connect you to your world. Care for them with the Eye Clinic of Fairbanks, your eye health professionals on Mini Street.
KFAR Weather.
Snow likely today, otherwise cloudy skies. Highs around 5 above, east winds around 5 miles an hour. Cloudy tonight, flurries likely, lows level off around 11 below. Flurries likely tomorrow, highs around 0. A dusting of snow today. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Derek Height.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Nick Nugent on a Wednesday here in the studio with me, and we're basically talking about the rescue of the Nanook and the loss of Carl Ben Ileson, all rolled into one.
Well, there was hope that 1929 would be a better year than 1928 based on two prior years. It turns out probably 28 was the average and 29 closely followed. The other 2 years have been outliers for good weather. The Nanook was rebuilt on Lake Washington and then brought to Elliott Bay where it was loaded. Basic cargo was flour, tea, canned goods, clothing, tobacco, small arms ammunition, and 380 cases of dynamite, which they couldn't load in Elliott Bay due to the proximity of Seattle. So they sailed out into one of the little passages in the islands there, had another ship bring the dynamite over for them.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess some sort of a very early attempt at a safety zone.
What mining operation was this going to be involved in, or was this going to be for the revolutionaries?
This was for the Russians, yeah. And they did have a number of mining operations going on in Siberia.
Wow.
Well, they set sail the evening of June 15th, 1929, and arrived in Dutch Harbor at noon on the 26th, found the cutter Haida there. The ship's captain was R.H. Weeding. Several members had worked for Svensson before. Unusually, Svensson brought his 17-year-old daughter, Marion, along. If a person has a subscription to, like, Newspapers, Inc. or Newspaper Archives, if you search Marion Svensson, you can find out a lot. She sent radio messages back, and the Seattle papers published them, and she actually became quite a celebrity.
Wow.
During this ordeal for a 17-year-old. And it's always, you know, some wonderful headlines of the day. Petite high school girl trapped in Arctic. So they left Cold Harbor, ran into some heavy seas that then calmed down, fortunately. They trolled while they were going, ended up filling 3 barrels of cod, which was a nice supplement to the food they had. They wind died down, and on the diesel engine, again, they were down 6 knots. They rounded St. Lawrence and were awakened at 5 the next morning as they started hitting small ice floes. They were in thick fog with ice all around, went to work trying to do their best to pick a course through the ice and actually stay pointed where they thought they were. The fog lifted suddenly, and they found themselves actually very near where they wanted to be. They landed at the village of Lavrentia and made contact with Russian officials, met the radio operators. Gleason, who wrote the book Icebound in the Siberian Arctic, which is a good summary of all these events, always went and met the other radio operators wherever there was a radio set, and learned how they tuned in their radios and their philosophy for tuning. Now, today it's kind of hard for us to think about that. What do you do if you want to listen to us on KFAR? You turn your radio on and you punch a button and there you are. Not true in the 20s, especially with these 500 meter long-wave radios they used.
Yeah.
Well, they were headed then to, while they were there, it turned out one of the crew members had lived for several years here at the Cape running a trading station for Svensson back before the Russian Revolution. And he had 2 sons amongst the Chukchi, and he brought his sons each a brand new 30-30 Winchester and a case of ammunition each, which that'd be like my giving you a Bugatti or something.
Yeah, exactly.
In the culture. So quite a generous gift. He had brought that family to the Yukon Pacific Exposition in 1909, but the wet winter had been pretty hard on their health. They went on to East Cape. They finally raised the Elisif by radio, found the ship was quite ice-fast and low on supplies. They unloaded at some small villages and kept continuing on. Taking the furs they had, they went back to Nome on July 5th and unloaded so they had more room. They could always ship furs out of Nome on down to Seattle. Gleason there again visited the radio station, met with the operators, and he states that they had delivered a fur cargo worth $350,000. Snow and ice were much less than on the Siberian side. Well, they departed Teller on the 8th of July then, heavily loaded with cargo to the point where the helmsman had trouble seeing around the deck cargo. They started running into heavy ice where there had been clear passage before. For 2 days, they made pretty poor progress and were finally stopped 2 days later near Kaliuchin Bay. That was the site of where the ship Vega had been iced in from September 1878 to July 79. Well, they were still for 17 days and in some danger from the ice. This time, though, allowed the Nanook to communicate with the Elisif, the Army communication stations, and a Russian ship, the Stavropol, which was working its way up the coast. The only problem they had at that point was using more of the generator fuel to run the radio than had been planned for. The next day, a very strong wind arose, broke them free. They were able to start moving, and fortunately, the LSF on the 29th broke free of the ice pack. They met up just north of North Cape and proceeded on with their plans from there. They were visited, interestingly, by a Russian flight from Wrangel Island, where a Junkers W-33 on floats landed nearby. The aviators were Krasinski, Valvieta, and Leningrad. They were pretty famous for their day for their Arctic exploits on the Russian side. Svensson, being pretty astute, sent a news article to the Associated Press about the flight, knowing that it would be published and his ships would be part of the story.
Smart man.
Very clever. Well, August 2nd, they had contrary winds. All shipping had to remain where they were. Stayed that way for 6 days. And then they got a radio message that another Russian freighter, the Kalema, was free of the ice and proceeding south. On the 9th of August, all four ships were anchored near North Cape and spent some time discussing conditions, and they all set out at 11 a.m. on the 9th, not realizing this was actually the final voyage of the LSF. Nanook could make good time. It had shallower draft. It could get in closer to the shore and zip along in the open leads that were caused by rivers flow. They were, by midnight, out of sight of the other ships. On August 10th, they rounded Cape Billings and found out, unfortunately, the way ahead was directly into the current and gale-force winds. LSF radioed they were 30 miles behind and having a bad time of it. On the 11th, all the pitching prevented the use of the radio until 8 p.m., and when Gleason turned the radio on, he found out the LSF was broadcasting an SOS. They were beached after having struck a flow at 6:30, and by 7 realized that there was enough water coming in that the pumps weren't going to be able to keep up with it. Well, the Nanook was faced then with a situation that seems odd to us today. The U.S. Army transmitter at Nome was shut down for the day and wouldn't be opening the next day because the next day was Sunday. The Russians were not up and on the air because this was early enough. A lot of ships just turned the radios off at night. And the U.S. cutter Northland was at St. Michael, and that was too far away for the radio capability they had. Well, finally, about midnight, when conditions were better, they reached the cutter Haida and were able to relay the news to various locales. Gleason actually eventually reached the U.S. Navy transmitter at St. Paul, 1,000 miles away. They made contact with a Russian breaker, the Litki, and the Stavropol. The Stavropol had been delayed and was only 35 miles west of the LSF. By the afternoon of the 13th, the Russians had arrived and picked the LSF crew up. Nobody aboard the LSF wanted to go back north. They've been iced in
they
for
been,
one
way. They had enough of it.
They can see where the signs are pointing. So they all chose to take their open launches and make for East Cape. And some decided they would stay and salvage cargo until they could be removed. The trip was 500 miles in open boats. As the Russian ships left, communications were cut when the Army would not open the station at Nome at midnight when skip conditions were the best. That wasn't in their operating rules. So Gleason made the best of it using a shortwave set he had brought along and reached a ship, the SS Wisconsin, 1,800 miles away on a voyage between Portland and Shanghai.
That's how why you tune in your radio.
Absolutely.
Fairbanks, we're going to stop here for a little bit. We're going to have some bumper music, the Spin Doctors. What time is it? And I have no idea what that is. We're going to have some Fox News, some state news, some commercials, some weather. And we'll be back after this.
Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
The White House says President Biden successfully put Republicans on defense over Social Security and Medicare cuts after they jeered him during his State of the Union address.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said of that exchange,
he called out members out on live television in front of millions of Americans and effectively put them on the defense.
Republican leaders have insisted the national debt can be significantly reduced without cuts to entitlement programs.
Fox's Jared Halpern at the White House. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un makes a public appearance for a major anniversary.
It's 75 years since North Korea's army was founded, and the capital, Pyongyang, appears to be setting up for a massive military parade. Before that, though, Kim Jong-un went to meet troops, lauding what he called the irresistible might of his armed forces.
Fox's Jonathan Savage. America is listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
The Fairbanks Daily News Minor reports that five attorneys have applied for a position on the Fairbanks Superior Court. Judge Paul Lyle was appointed to the Fairbanks Superior Court on February 19, 2008, by former Governor Sarah Palin. He replaced Judge Nisha Steinkruger. Lyle will retire July 20th because he will meet the mandatory retirement age of 70. The Alaska Judicial Council will evaluate each applicant through background investigations, personal interviews, and a survey of other attorneys. A public hearing will take place in May 2023. The seven-member council will nominate two or more candidates to Governor Mike Dunleavy. The candidates are Tom V. Jamochian, Risa Leonard, William Montgomery, Spencer Rupert, and Amy Welch. And finally, the Alaska State Trooper Criminal Suppression Unit has said that car thefts are on the rise in the Fairbanks area, as well as people stealing catalytic converters. The AST Criminal Suppression Unit started beta operations in response to car thefts. The unit is leaving cars running with keys in them, and if someone drives away with that car, troopers will track it and arrest them.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Amy Seiberlich here to tell you about Health Talk. Every Saturday at noon, join Dr. Scott Looper from White Spruce Medical and special guests like me who have our fingers on the pulse of Fairbanks Golden Heart. Learn about a wide range of topics and pick up some beneficial health tips and practical health information pertinent to interior Alaskans. Listen live every Saturday at noon or online anytime at KFARradio.com. Health Talk with Dr. Looper, brought to you by White Spruce Medical. Check us out at whitesprucemedical.com.
Don't miss Fairbanks Foodies every Saturday at 5:30 on KFAR Radio with your host, David Pruse, discussing everything food in Fairbanks, from awesome recipes to all of your favorite local restaurants. Brought to you by Bobby's Downtown, Quality Food Sales, Hoodoo Brewery, and the Fairbanks Community Food Bank. Don't miss Fairbanks Foodies and go to the archives page of KFARradio.com to listen to any past episodes. Fairbanks Foodies, Saturdays at 5:30 on KFAR Radio and streaming live at KFARradio.com. And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Nick Nugent in the studio with me on this History Wednesday. So, the Alicia is down for the count, not coming back.
The Nanook made it all the way to the destination they had and was able to pick things up. The Russian freighter caught up with them at that point, and it took 3 days to unload everything because the dock was rather small, and the Russians had some more critical cargo, although they did bring a lot of the cargo from the Elisif. So most of what needed to get there made it. After that 3 days, Nanook turned around, headed down the river, came out, and was able to make contact again with the Coast Guard cutter, revenue cutter, Northland. They found that ship was riding out a storm at Teller, but a little bit more frightening, they found out that on September 1st, the crew of the Elisif had got tired of waiting, and ice was starting to overrun the shelterage they were in, so they took back off and decided to go to Diomede Island. They basically made it from the far eastern coast of Siberia to Diomede Island in two open boats with barges during Beaufort Scale 11 winds, which is well into a hurricane. And
oh, my God.
They made Diomede Island, where they were picked up by the Coast Guard or the Revenue Service and made it to Teller, Nome, and eventually back to Seattle. So they made it out okay. But after a pretty, it kind of reminded me of Shackleton's adventure, yeah, where you're just out across open ocean. And they had been blowing 70 miles off course at one point and still made it back.
They just don't make them like they used to.
No, absolutely not. Well, the ship's crew then had been near North Cape when the ice and the approaching storm had, again, the Ellisif's crew had been forced out. They were gone. The Northland went back on patrol, so it was a ship that they could stay at least in contact with. Meanwhile, the Nanook and Stavropol had linked up near Aeon Island, and a rather unfortunate decision was made. The Russian captain was ill. He was coming down with pneumonia and was feverish, wasn't making great decisions, and he told the icebreaker Litki they didn't need them. The Litki went off to do other things,
yeah,
and now the two freighters are kind of on their own. Well, after a few days with no progress made, they heard the Stavropol radioing for urgent help. The Litki was not able to return at that point. They had standing orders once they were a certain number of miles away from a location. They could not return there without direct orders from Moscow. Those orders never came. The Northland had to depart also. They were blowing off course, and they were actually running low on supplies. So only the Russian ship was near the Nanook, and it was already ice fast. Good news was that they heard the crew of the Ellisif had made it all the way to Seattle. Now, on October 4th, 1929, the Nanook dropped anchor and did not move until July 8th, 1930. They were within walking distance of a village, the little village at North Cape, and a bit longer trip to the Stavropol. Many of the passengers on the Stavropol actually belonged to a Russian scientific expedition that had been taking place, and the Russians were very concerned about getting those people taken off the ship and brought back, because they realized if anything happened, there wasn't enough shelter to take care of that many people and enough food, so they were hoping to get them off. They also found out, the crew of the Nanook did, you had to be careful what you said, because the village was about 50-50 divided between supporting the white Russians and supporting the Bolsheviks. So it could be very dangerous you got in the wrong conversation.
Yeah.
Well, the crew started checking for suitable landing areas. They got permission from Russia to go ahead and have flights to the area. The Nanook was winterized with materials they brought along. Svensson had shaped the planking they had to help deflect wind, and he also parked the bow of the ship to the northwest, where 80-90% of the storms came from, so that it would have a less area to work on. The first air prices they were quoted to fly out of Nome or Teller were $700 per passenger, $3 per pound of fur, or $4,200 per trip. Well, Gleason and Marion, the radio operator and the captain's daughter, started sewing up bags to hold furs. And when permission came from Moscow, the person that stepped forward was Ben Eielson. And his company, Alaskan Airways of Fairbanks, which was a brand new company at the time, agreed to flights based out of Teller. On October 26th, Frank Dorband arrived in Teller with a Stinson Detroiter. He let them know that Eielson would bring the larger Hamilton, which Wien had used back in March, and the Russians had sent the Litki back to Providence Bay, where they could actually launch their float plane when weather was agreeable. Eielson's aircraft unfortunately damaged a wheel strut landing at Nome, so he sent Dorband ahead. And on the 29th, the weather of October, the weather was great on both sides, and the flight was on. Took him 6.5 hours to get there, and all he was able to deliver was mail, cigarettes, and a case of coffee. The rest of his aircraft was needed to hold the aviation fuel that he himself had to use to get back. So that sort of became a pattern of a lot of this rescue.
Yeah.
They had to carry so much fuel, they could bring little with them, but they could take a lot more back. Well, Dorband was a bit of a braggart, had sort of a reputation for that, and he sent a radio message. Pioneer Alaskan pilot Frank Dorband completed a hazardous 6-hour and 20-minute flight from Teller to North Cape in a Stinson Detroiter to rescue Nanook's crew. And a little bit of self-promotion again seemed to be something that went along with the job. Well, Eielson's repairs were complete. He arrived with mechanic Earl Borland, made a landing on wheels on the beach. They only took 4 hours and 20 minutes in a much larger, faster aircraft. Gleason, the radio operator, got to talk to Eielson as he stayed overnight, and he mentions that he particularly enjoyed Eielson and had written in his diary that he was quite looking forward to the evenings they'd be spending together after the flight so he could learn a lot more about Alaska and flying in the area, not knowing he would never see Eielson again.
Wow.
So Eielson was able to take out two passengers, including the rather troublesome first mate, who everyone was glad to be rid of, and 1,000 pounds of furs. They departed at around 10 a.m., but due to weather, they didn't arrive at Nome till 4 days later after staying in a couple of villages along the coast till the storms finally blew out.
Wow.
That wasn't an unusual thing either. That's sort of the recurring history of these flights. Well, on November then, they returned to Teller. They were grounded for weather for 4 days. But on the 9th of November, both pilots decided to try the flight. Dorband returned to Teller due to extreme fog and reported that he had not ever actually contacted Eielson during the flight. Dorband reported aircraft trouble and couldn't take off again. And there were several days of clear weather, but Eielson didn't show up anywhere. So people were starting, obviously, to get worried. And actually, by mid-November, the fact that Eielson hadn't shown up somewhere was news all up and down the West Coast and throughout Alaska. On November 18th, two natives from Cape Siderski arrived at the Nanook and related that they had seen Eielson's aircraft late on the 9th in very poor visibility just before dark, and a trapper 50 miles away had heard a plane, but unfortunately it was headed inland. So he had overshot and was going too far. Instantly, the Nanook dispatched their dog sled to the general area to see if they could see smoke or anything else. Eielson was very well known in northern aviation. He'd made a flight from Barrow to Spitsbergen, made flights in Antarctica in 1928, kind of gave up the high-profile flying, came back to work on the air transport industry and in Alaska, which he loved. These trips in support of the Nanook were, in fact, the first large contract for the new Alaskan Airways. Well, Gleason then ended up being kind of a man in the spot. He was communications central, if you will, because a lot of the stations couldn't speak to each other, but he could relay the messages for them. The Litke arrived on the 23rd and was ready to lend air support however needed. The Nanook dog teams were still out with native guides. The weather was clear, but the temperatures hit minus 40, and the sun had been already below the horizon for several days, so they were only getting Arctic twilight most of the time. November 30th came with news the Litke was being blown off station and would have to retreat. One of the dog teams returned with conflicting reports, which isn't too unusual. They still thought Eielson might be inland. Joe Crossan had arrived with an open cockpit Waco and was at Teller awaiting weather. But storm after storm kept delaying everything, kept planes on the ground. Then, finally, one day, Harold Gillum shows up. So this is in November. Harold Gillum had only learned to fly in July and August of that year. And here he is in a little open airplane coming up to see what help he could give. I find that kind of amazing, too. So there were three Fairchild F-71s being sent up. And I guess, again, to show us the difference between then and now, they were shipped from the factory by the railroad, loaded on a Coast Guard cutter in Seattle, and then by the Alaska Railroad to Fairbanks, where they were assembled and flown to the coast.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. We're at 907-458-TALK, 907-458-8255, and we'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
You drive in a whole new world of possibilities with a Cooper Discoverer AT3 family of tires from GCR Tires and Service. Redefine the limits. The Cooper AT3 is aggressive and tough on rocks, loose gravel, and mud off the road, yet exceptionally quiet and responsive on the road. Alaska's roads are open. The AT3 will take you places you've never been before. The Cooper Discoverer AT3 family of tires. Buy yours at GCR Tires and Service. The Tire Guys. Taming the Alaskan Road. Van Horn at Cushman.
Yes, Taco Thursday is a thing, and it happens every Thursday at Big Daddy's. Big Daddy's serves up the most amazing chicken tacos, complete with shredded cheese. These chicken tacos are delicious and filling, and you can enjoy them for just $1.50 each every Thursday at Big Daddy's Barbecue. And don't miss out on those sides as well, including fries, okra, baked beans. The menu is full of great ideas and great value. We'll see you for Chicken Taco Thursday at Big Daddy's on Wickersham between 1st and 2nd Avenues, the northernmost Southern Barbecue. Big Daddy's.
Weather This Hour brought to you by Long Building Technologies. Make your building the smartest around. Call Long today to find out about their building intelligence systems that will save you money. 561-3044. Or find out more at long.com.
KFAR Weather.
Chance of snow today. Otherwise, overcast skies. Highs level off around 5 above. Southwesterly winds around 5 miles per hour. Chance for snow again tonight. Lows dip down to about 9 below. Overcast skies. Sunshine mixed with clouds at times tomorrow. Daytime highs approaching 1 above. A dusting of snow today. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Nick Nugent in the studio here. It's a beautiful Wednesday. Go ahead, sir.
Well, finally, on December 21st at 1:45, the first of the planes from Teller came, and it was Gillum. Crosson arrived after staying with some natives along the coast a bit later, so they were able to start their search pattern. Christmas came and went. They were only able to fly 2 days during December due to poor visibility and weather. The 30th, Gillum had an engine failure caused by bad fuel and extreme cold and pretty seriously damaged his aircraft on landing. And the Fairchilds were in Fairbanks, having been shipped. They were, one of the Fairchilds was damaged by an engine failure in Fairbanks, hit a tree on landing. Another one was forced down near the coast. Fortunately, that one had Jim Hutchison on board, who's
fixed it.
Well, yeah, got him going pretty quickly. Conflicting reports were coming in from people on the ground about what they'd heard. And, you know, you think about, okay, there's an airplane somewhere. I'm out in the middle of nowhere. Wind's blowing. Where is the sound coming from? So they were getting a little bit confused, but kept going. Finally, on the 26th of January, Crosson and Gillum set off as early as possible, and about noon the first plane came back. It was Gillum with the news that the wreck had been found. And what they had spotted was one of the Hamilton's wings sticking up, cast a shadow on the snow, or they may not have seen it at all if they hadn't had a bit of sun. It was a total wreck, and it was evident that from the wreckage that Eielson and Borland would have been killed instantly. Site was 10 miles inland and about 90 miles from the Nanook. We find out later that because of the way the airplane hit on this small bluff, it split and the occupants were catapulted forward and actually were found several hundred feet away from the main wreckage. That's what took so long to recover.
Wow.
Well, they radioed Teller then so that fruitless and dangerous flights wouldn't be made. Crosson noted that the altimeter was reading 1,000 feet, The ridge was only 50 feet above sea level, and the throttle was full open. The clock was stopped at 3:40 teller time. So they were flying full speed and apparently, for whatever reason, just never saw the bluff they hit. Well, now they had to carry on. Eielson and Borland had to be located and removed, of course. Crossan and Gillam needed to return because their small aircraft just weren't much good at this point with everything that needed to be done. And they also hoped to get some of the furs to market if possible. It was becoming a very unstable market because this is right when the Great Depression started. January 28th, the weather cleared enough to allow the Fairchilds to arrive. Crossan and Gillam departed. Two Russian aircraft arrived the next day, and Crossan was named head of all U.S. and Canadian efforts. Turned out he was the perfect guy. He was very good at organizing under this type of condition, and couldn't have had anybody better other than maybe Eielson himself. Well, the search continued. Fuel was becoming critical, and one of the Fairchilds returned to Teller on February 7th to load up with fuel, and they also took Svensson and his daughter out. Svensson had lost a son in the diphtheria epidemic at Nome and was really fearful for his daughter's safety.
Yeah.
So they came out, and they made it back then to Seattle. Planes were recovering, and Jim Hutchison was there, so there were some repairs being made as the aircraft needed them. On March 4th, the two flyers' bodies were finally located and loaded aboard Ed Young's Fairchild. Crossan and Reed returned to Alaska with him. The Russians were resented by Slepinov, who accompanied them in one of these junkers all the way to Fairbanks. It took till March 10th with weather to reach Fairbanks, one day more than 4 months after the accident.
That's a heck of a commitment to find them.
It was.
In the winter, the depths of the winter, the worst time of the year to be out there, and they kept at it.
And Harold Gillam, the new kid on the block, flying an open cockpit airplane in all this weather. Well, after that, then, they were able to get the damaged F-71. One of them had a lot of wind, and there was some roughness, and they'd clipped a little snow berm and damaged the landing skis. So they got that Fairchild ready to go. Finally, Crossan's Waco and the Fairchild departed on May 10th, and the crew remaining, the ship's crew, settled into a routine waiting the time when the ice would go. Gleason, the radio operator, sadly received news that his father passed away during this period of time. The captain, who we'd talked about, settled into an interesting pattern of drinking all the vodka the Russians had given them for the crew. So on July 8th...
That's a unique pattern.
Yes, it was. On July 8th, they were finally able to get underway. The ice rod, a good wind came up, broke the ice away from the ship, and they sailed to meet Svensson, who had another new ship called the Carice, and they met him near Cape Vankarim. Svensson transferred Captain Carl M. Henson, who had sailed with Amundsen, so there's a pretty good hand for you, to take the Nanook back to Seattle. They took on fuel at Nome on July 17th, made Dutch Harbor on the 22nd, and eventually, after sailing in really good weather, on 11 p.m. on August 2nd, they finally made it back to Seattle. From any viewpoint, this had been pretty much a disaster.
Yes.
Two lives were lost, less than half the fur recovered, one airplane destroyed, three badly damaged, and the ship Ellisif lost. Well, 2 years after this, the Nanook kind of gets a little bit of a revival in life, if you will. It was leased by MGM for the movie Eskimo Mala the Magnificent. Captain Hansen took the little ship to Teller where it was purposely frozen in a better location. And famous silent movie star Anna May Wong played the part of the Eskimo heroine. They were a film that won an Academy Award, mostly for being filmed in the Arctic. But it wasn't a box office. It was a box office failure, even after MGM re-released it with some additional spicy scenes included. That being before the motion picture code.
Yeah.
In 1933, MGM purchased the Nanook, and it starred in Mutiny off the Bounty and Treasure Island. By 1941, the ship was struck from the registry. Alaska Airways was purchased by Pan American Airways in 1932 with some other small companies, and Pacific Alaska Airways was created. They flew a lot of mail routes with the same F-71s that had been involved in the search. So those aircraft had pretty good long lives. PAA initiated the first Fairbanks to Juneau service in 1935, as well as the first Alaska to Seattle service in 1940. PAA became the Alaska division of Pan Am. Carlson was made the division manager. And, of course, through the 70s, you probably remember that big Pan Am 747 every day on its from New York to Fairbanks to Tokyo.
Yep. And the one that went from Fairbanks to Seattle.
Yeah. That lasted till 1978, then, when all Alaskan operations were terminated. So just an example of how these early flyers were always there for each other. They put in whatever effort it took, and I think it makes a pretty interesting introduction to our probably coming back to Eielson at some point.
Yeah, next month we'll do Sig and Noel Ween. You know, the interior has such incredible heritage in Alaska. It really does.
We do, and particularly aviation. And a lot of the people who realized mail routes, a number of things could be done with aircraft, they were flying in some pretty rough weather, pretty incredible conditions.
Yeah, just, man.
It's kind of surprising that a lot of the things that, here's a pun, took off, actually did. You know, if you think about it, it's just, it always amazes me that as many things worked as worked. And I think we'll enjoy the Weens next month. Certainly long time Alaskan aviation story there.
Mm-hmm. True. What do you got planned for the weekend? Anything fun?
Well, I'm not entirely sure right now.
It is just about over the hump.
It is. We're just getting awful close. I've been listening to Fairbanks Foodies and have been
cast iron month. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of fun. I've been thinking about trying a cast iron pizza.
Ooh.
So you get it super hot. Yeah. It makes that really good crackly cheese crust around the edge.
And that's the thing about cast iron. You don't need, you know, once you get it there, you don't need much to keep it there.
No.
It just retains the heat so well. And you can put it on your stovetop and put it in the oven or vice versa. And it's a lot of fun.
I like to get cast iron really hot and basically take scallops and just give them about 90 seconds on each side, and they crisp up so nicely.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Fairbanks, that is our show for today. We went from history to food in a heartbeat. Fairbanks, you have a great day. I will see you on Friday, and take care.